So welcome. Thanks a lot for waking up.
I really appreciate it.
I went to sleep early last night. We're here this morning to talk about nonprofit news. And I think the fact that this many people, nonprofit environmental news, and I think the fact that this many people were willing to get up this early is a testament both to the condition of our industry and also the hopes that people have put in this particular sector. So what we hope to do today is to hold up a magnifying glass to some models that are out here that are already clicking, working at least to some extent, and try to figure out where the difficulties are, where the pressure points are, but also what's scalable, what works, what can be transferred. So that's our goal. I was asked to start off with a very quick overview of the field, so I thought that's what I would do. I will try to rush through that before giving way to our panelists. They have also promised to speak quickly with their prepared remarks, so we want to leave the maximum amount possible for Q&A before we need to say goodbye a little bit after 8:45. Nonprofit environmental coverage is certainly not new. Public broadcasting has been doing it for a very long time and doing it quite well. So publications like High Country News, which has been around, believe it or not, since 1970 and has been very robust. There are surely things that we can learn from those veterans, and I'm sure that we will hear from some of them in the Q&A and also next year in Montana. But it is also surely true that nonprofit news gathering has never been more important than it is right now. There are some complicated reasons for that. Secular changes, the long-term decline of print media that began long before the arrival of this particular thing. The strange new world of the Internet. That was from 1994, Time magazine cover. Feels like only yesterday, doesn't it? But in another way, it seems like ancient history. This thing arrived called the Internet that has changed everything. The web is awash in environmental information, some of it quite useful. But it is not awash in professional environmental journalism that is fair and contextual and credible and is aimed at a non-specialized audience. That's the kind of journalism that plays such a vital role in helping citizens make informed decisions. Professional journalism, including environmental journalism, is experiencing deep problems, as we all know, because the for-profit models are not moving well to the web. There are some complicated reasons for that, but if we try to summarize them, almost no one seems willing to pay for news on the web. And advertisers aren't willing to support it, at least not sufficiently to fund deep reporting. Here's a cheery note from a Wall Street firm. The notion that the enormous cost of real news gathering might be supported by the ad load or display advertising down the side of the page, or by the revenue share from having a Google search box in the corner of the page, or even by a 15-second teaser from that gecko at Geico prior to a news clip is idiotic on its face. So thank you, Sanford Bernstein, for that helpful bit of information. Now, that's just one firm's opinion. It's too early to say that quality journalism on the web will never be fully supported by the old advertising and or CIRC subscription model. And, in fact, we're likely to find out very soon whether paywalls will work on a large scale when it comes to general interest news. We may find out in the next 12 months, and it's going to be, well, it's going to be a very high pressure, high risk, high reward kind of experiment that a number of legacy media are going to undertake. And we'll see how that goes. But for now, at least, we have to be clear-eyed about it and say there's precious little evidence that the old revenue models are working to fund traditional public service journalism on the web. Yes, we're seeing some new kinds of journalism on the web, non-traditional. Some of them are quite good, terrific blogger-driven projects, depending on who they are. Some are delivering crowdsourced, hyper-local, hyper-specialized, highly opinionated news. Here's one of my favorites. I don't know if Osha Davidson is here, but he does a fantastic job. But as Osha or any blogger could tell you, these sites, generally speaking, especially the high-quality ones, do not pay. They don't pay very well. It's very difficult to make a living this way unless you augment your income somewhere else. So I'm telling you something that most of you already know, but I think it's important to lay the predicate for the discussion that's coming next. And this does leave us now, well, you can see where we're going. The advertising and subscription models are so problematic, and that leaves the third major source of potential revenue, namely charitable support via individuals. Like, here's an exciting project, Spot US. At least the concept is quite intriguing. The product themselves, the stories are inconsistent, but it's an intriguing idea. Individuals are one important source. So are, of course, private foundations. This is environmentalhealthnews.org. Marla is here. Doug Fisher is here. But Climate Daily, Daily Climate, they do a very exciting job. So does Climate Central. Mike Leminick is here. Private foundations, universities. Many of you, I hope, have seen the E360 site funded by Yale University, as well as a number of foundations. And occasionally, even government agencies have gotten into the business of directly funding news. This is a site that I like. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped advocacy group-funded sites, which are booming on the web. Some of them are much better than others. In my opinion, this is one of the better ones on Earth. And then government agencies. This site is sadly lost its funding from the National Science Foundation, but Science Central did a very good job. So nonprofit status is anything but a panacea, as these folks will tell us, but it is also quite exciting. The sites that have struggled the most are the ones that have tried to address critical gaps in coverage, especially general interest sites aimed at general audiences at the local and state level. The folks who do the watchdogging of government agencies, even school boards, very hyper-local sites, there's a model that can work for them to some extent, but the sites that scale up a little to the municipal level, the state level, have had a much harder time. The going's been very rough. Here's the Chi-Town Daily News, the late Chi-Town Daily News, although it's maybe reconstituted. The Rocky Mountain Independent, the second site to shut down, well, third if you include the Rocky Mountain News, in the Denver area within the last year. So that brings us to our panel, all of whom represent nonprofits that are experimenting with innovative models that seem to have a good chance of not only surviving in this rough environment, but also, not incidentally, of paying decent salaries, a working wage, to professional journalists who can and do deliver high-quality environmental news to a general audience. In other words, with help from their funder angels, they are making a go of this. So I've asked each of them to speak very briefly about their organizations and to be specific about the size of their budgets and staffs, as well as the sources of their organization's revenues. I've asked them to talk about how they deal with potential conflicts between their news agenda and the policy agendas of their funders. Critical new issue. Actually, not so new. Anybody who's ever worked at a newspaper with an activist publisher is very familiar with that particular conflict. And most importantly, I've asked them to address whether and how their particular model may be replicable elsewhere. Are there templates for success here? I know we all certainly hope so. So our first speaker is Rob Davis, who is not, incidentally, a newly elected member of the SCJ board. Congratulations, Rob. Rob is the environmental writer at The Voice of San Diego, which when we shift back eventually, you'll see a screenshot of The Voice of San Diego. He grew up in Maryland, and he worked in newspapers in Virginia before moving to San Diego in 2005 and then making the jump to nonprofit news. So I'll introduce the rest of our panelists when we get to them. But for now, please welcome Rob Davis.
Can everybody hear me? Okay, there we go. Good morning. Thanks for getting up. It's cold and cold outside. We started in 2005, and the idea then was that there was a fairly sizable gap in San Diego between what should be covered and what actually was being covered. San Diego at that time was embroiled in a scandal over how it was funding its pension system and with something called Strippergate. And my editor was one who helped break the story of the pension scandal for a local business paper. And retired venture capitalist and some of his friends were kind of watching this unfold and saying, how is this happening? How has nobody seen this coming? And at that point, our local newspaper had 1,400 people on staff. They have 750 now, and they have almost cut the size of their newspaper in half. And what we have tried to do is to step into that ever-widening gap. We have 8 full-time reporters. One of them is a year-long investigative fellowship. We have $1 million budget. And so we certainly are not a complete solution by any means. But what we have tried to do is to maintain a laser-sharp focus on what we're doing and to focus on what we saw not being done in the community 4 years ago and what surely has been sacrificed as the newspaper has shrunk, and that is accountability journalism. And holding people in the community and the elected leadership of the community accountable for how they spend money, for any number of good or bad decisions that they may make. And that ultimately, I think, is the sort of noble reason that a lot of us get into journalism, is the idea of making a difference in the community and writing stories that have impact. And that's specifically what we try to focus on. I don't have weekend duty. I don't cover the air show. I don't go to a city council meeting just because the meeting is happening. We, from the start, knew that we didn't have to do that, and that if we tried to be the paper of record, that we would fail, and I wouldn't be here right now because nobody would have had any interest in funding us. We have a $1 million budget now, which is about tripled since we started in 2005. We get now about 40% of our money from foundations, 30% of it from large donors, and another 30% of it from individual members and corporate sponsorship. We're coming up on our 1,000th donor, and that's something that we want to keep expanding. My focus from the start has been in essentially creating the environment beat from scratch. I was the 4th reporter to come on and have focused on spelling out the local impacts of climate change, on explaining our water supply and what is not working with it. One of the things that has endeared me to the local elected leadership is that in California, if you set water rates, your bills are public information. And we had a city councilman who was known as being a very ardent environmentalist and was always preaching water conservation, and at home was using 1 million gallons a year. And so our reporting on that and his promise to use less and his subsequent failure to use less has had a fairly profound impact on his political aspirations. Scalability. Can other people do what we do? Absolutely. Voice of OC is starting. We don't have a financial relationship with them, but they are using our model and taking advice from us. There are outfits in St. Louis, in Minnesota, and it's one starting in Texas. The Bay Area News Project just announced that it has $5 million in funding. California Watch, which is an outcropping of the Center for Investigative Reporting, has started. And I think that we are making it clear to people that, one, our work is having an impact, and two, that makes it a valuable public service that is worthy of funding. Within the last year, we've done some of our most impactful work. I spent most of last summer, we called it the Summer of Redevelopment. Really sexy topic. We had two nonprofits in San Diego focused on taking tax money and reinvesting it in blighted areas. The executive one of those agencies was negotiating the finer points of a $400 million hotel and condo deal with a business partner that was paying her money while they were in the negotiations. The executive of the other was keeping positions open in the neediest neighborhoods in San Diego and, without any approval, awarding herself that money at the end of the year as a bonus. And on the morning that our story ran, the mayor of San Diego sent her a memo that began, I read the Voice of San Diego this morning and I'm extraordinarily troubled by this. And which led to an audit, which led to findings of fraud and FBI investigations into both of them. In terms of our firewall, we have made it very clear to people, to our funders, that they don't get a say in what stories we write. People are funding positions, whether it's focused on neighborhoods or focused on the environment or focused on science, but they don't get to have a hand in our editorial meetings, and we've been clear with them, and nobody has tried to influence our editorial direction, which has actually been, I think, a surprise to all of us. People often ask, well, would you go after somebody that is a funder or who does fundraising for you? And the chairman of our local airport authority was a fundraiser for us. And I just finished a series of stories that led for calls for him to resign. Because he used public money to go see the Chargers play in London, said he took a member of parliament when I interviewed him, and after folks in San Diego kind of poked around to see whether that was true, it turned out that he had actually taken his niece's husband. He is been under a fair amount of scrutiny since then, and there have been outlets, as Dan mentioned, that have failed. And, you know, one of the issues that they have had, I think, is a lack of fundraising infrastructure or people, business people on their board. In with the Rocky Mountain experiment, they tried to get money up front, and I think it's very difficult to fund an idea. We were fortunate to have money from the start, and we realized early on that if we were going to make a name for ourselves, it was going to be through the journalism that we did and the impact that we had on the community. And so we were, I think, very fortunate in that regard to have a commitment from somebody who was interested in doing this and be able to take that money and influence the community. I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's a good place to stop. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
So our next speaker is Melinda Wittstock. She's a veteran of the BBC, ABC News, NPR, MSNBC, and three London newspapers. And she gave all that up to found the Capital News Connection. I will show you a screen capture of the Capital News Connection. Whoops, sorry. Here it is. Capital News Connection, as Melinda will tell us, covers Congress from a local perspective for public radio stations nationwide. So she has a very interesting model that she created, as she'll tell us, that filled a niche that really wasn't being filled. The Capital News Connection slogan, borrowed from Tip O'Neill, is "All politics is local." So take it away.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I think of Capital News Connection as a little engine that could, because so many things that we've achieved have been very much against the odds. And when I look back on it, it's almost amazing. We've been around now for 7 years, and we started in 2003 with, well, actually, really, it was really 2002 that I had the idea, and it was on a one-sheet piece of paper. And I talked to a few people in public radio and started calling around news directors and saying, hey, how come you don't have your own correspondence on Capitol Hill? You know, because our national government is essentially a geographic-based government. It's reported only as if it's a national story, and it's reported only as if it was a boxing match. And there are important issues. The political reporting really isn't about reporting the issues anymore. It should be. And it's not being localized. It's not being made relevant to where people live and work, and their lawmakers, all 535 of them, aren't really being held properly accountable. So why don't you have your own correspondent up on Capitol Hill? And the answer was pretty basic. We can't afford one. It's too expensive. And so the next question came, well, what could you afford to pay? And from those series of calls came an idea for a model, I suppose, that would allow anybody their own correspondent on Capitol Hill for a fraction of what they'd have to pay to do it themselves, delivering highly customized news for local public radio station newsrooms, specifically from Congress. And we do politics, but we don't do horse race politics. So, you know, when we look at an issue, we look at anything from, say, gas fracking to, you know, what's going on with climate change. I know, Rob, you mentioned the local impacts of climate change, so we'll report that. And we report really through we use Congress as a prism, I guess, it's an angle through which we report on issues and life. And there are three main areas in which we do that. How does national legislation, how does it impact locally where you live and work? What's your representative doing or not doing? Are they the same people in Washington as they are back home? The answer is usually not quite, and we bring that to light. And we really just focus on what are they doing all day. We also bring issues, local issues of controversy or concern to national attention. During the stimulus debate, it was fascinating to be able to walk up to Mitch McConnell and say, because all the Republicans had voted against the stimulus bill, and but then we found that a lot of them were putting out news releases locally, taking credit for how much money they'd brought home. So we had this kind of national perspective and an insight that gets us a lot of exclusives just by looking at things locally and asking questions differently than everybody else who's up there. Over the years, we've seen the numbers of people covering Congress dwindle to the point where we're pretty much the only source left there now that's actually localizing Congress. So let me talk a little bit about the model and how that happened. So I'm going to go back to that one-page sheet of paper and that little marketing experiment of mine while I was freelancing at the time and talk to Public Radio International. They got excited about it, and they said, we should call up the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and see what they say. So I had a conversation with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, sent them the kind of one page. They say, hey, you know, you should really apply. And I said, well, when's the deadline? What do I have to do? And I said, well, the deadline's Friday. It was like Tuesday or something. And it's like, well, what do you need? And it was this huge kind of application, and I felt like I was back in college, like studying for finals or something. I had this massive thing to crank out. I'd never written a grant application before. I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, it was... anyway, it took about a year to get funding, and in that time, I actually had a baby. In that time that it took to get the funding, the initial grant was $230,000, and that funded myself, one other half-time correspondent, and an assignment editor who would also report and coordinate with all the stations and would also do all the technology, like get our booth set up in the radio TV gallery and like buy the ISDN and do all the technology. You know, so it was crazy. There were three of us just doing everything. And when I wasn't reporting, I was also doing payroll, and I was also trying to fundraise. I was also trying to create a board of directors. I was trying, you know, I mean, a zillion things. I was trying to do the marketing. I mean, all this stuff that I'd never done before in my life. So it's been a really sharp learning curve to take all this on, and very, you know, vocationally satisfying in a lot of ways, but also, you know, be careful what you wish for, because that was a lot, really, for any one person to take on. Anyway, as a result, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is very, very strict about grantee requirements and what you have to do for what. So they gave us a pretty aggressive set of benchmarks, both quantitative and qualitative, that we had to live up to. For instance, you must do 500 stories in the first year. You must raise X amount of station revenue. Stations have to be paying you. You can only sign 10 stations because we don't want you to stretch too far. And we had all these limits. And it was actually good for us. It gave us some discipline. So in the first year, we blew through all their requirements. We did 629 stories. We signed 18 stations. And we brought in about $300,000 worth of station revenue. On that basis, they gave us a new grant because we'd succeeded. So we got up to like about $1 million for the next 2 years to scale it, because it was a scalable model. As it stands now, we're heard on 206 public radio stations around the country. Stations pay anywhere from $10,000 a year to $50,000 a year for the service, depending on what they want. We joke that our slogan should be, you decide, we report. So anyway,
<That's good.
laughs> so they pay us, and there are different packages of service that they can pay, so depending on how much they want and what they can afford. And we give them a mix of services that they can use. It's really flexible. That accounts for about 40% of our revenue right now. We have almost 3.2 million listeners now. And so the stations pay on these yearly contracts, and that's about 40% of our revenue. I mean, public radio, we launched this model with a very poor clientele, and so they didn't really have much money to give us, so as a result, we really had to make it up on foundation fundraising and other types of fundraising, and this is one of my sharpest learning curves, because trying to be a journalist and trying to fundraise at the same time is really difficult. I mean, it's very time-consuming. I had lunch with Chuck Lewis, you may know him formerly of the Center for Public Integrity, who said that at the center, they never really hit their stride until they had enough money to hire a full-time development and grants person. And I still can't get that person because no foundation will fund it. So it means that all the foundations are saying, well, you got to find a model that's sustainable, but then they never give you the positions that you need to be able to be sustainable. So you're always stuck in this chicken and egg thing, and you can't quite get beyond it, and that's where we're at right now. You know, it's really good that you have a lot of major donors and also individual donors, and that's a direction that we're trying to go in, but that's also time-consuming. It takes a while to really develop those relationships. So we're trying to do a little. We're launching a new website. Looks much better than that one, which we're going to launch in about a week. And we're going to experiment with some crowdfunding models and also try and drive donations around some of the interactive things that we do now too, as we go more into an interactive type service as well. So our foundations consist of, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has stuck with us over the long haul, like 7 years now. We're funded by our environmental coverage, specifically is funded by the Park Foundation. And so they have supported us for about 5 years now. We do a lot of environmental coverage. I mean, hundreds of stories every year for all our stations all across the country. We've had grants from the Kellogg Foundation for some of the rural coverage that we do. We have a grant from the Carnegie Corporation of New York for our immigration coverage and on. So we tend to succeed in getting grants for specific coverage. Speaking to your issue, the firewall issue, we've never really had any problems in that, but one of the things that you have to be very clear about when you're asking for the grant is making clear what the deliverables actually are. So we always say, well, we're going to cover these stories, but we're not going to tell you what the outcome is going to be of each of those stories. And it's got to be clear from the outset so expectations are managed. But we've never really had an issue with that. It's always, here are the number of stories we're going to do. A lot of foundations are keen to know about the impact of the work, that it caused somebody to do something somewhere. That's a challenge because it's very difficult to quantify. Someone hears your story on Kalamazoo Radio, are they going to go and change the world as a result, and how can you track that? So that's a real challenge in terms of raising foundation money. The other part of our budget, as we try and diversify our revenue streams, because frankly, too much of it comes from foundations, and foundations can be, they can change their minds, they change their programs every now and again, so you think you're in with them, and then someone gets fired from the foundation, or they just change their focus or whatever, and you're, what are we going to do? So that's kind of tricky. So the thing that we're trying very hard to do right now is diversify that. Because of some of the programs that we do for public radio, we're now in a position where we can offer corporate underwriting. And so, for instance, a segment called Power Breakfast that we do in Washington, that looks forward to the day ahead with a lot of exclusive reporting, like what's going to happen today. And it's exclusive, it's sound rich, it's doing very well. We're starting to get a lot of corporate sponsors. And there's a very strict firewall. We have strict policy about what's acceptable and what's not. And where it gets tricky is when someone like Raytheon decides that they want to sponsor Power Breakfast. You know, what do you do? You know, do you turn it down or, and that, we haven't faced that yet. I mean, that's going to be something that comes up, I'm sure. And also around the web as we try and figure out how to do corporate sponsorship on the web as well, because that kind of sponsorship can tarnish your quality and independent journalism in a way that would be quite detrimental at the same time. I'd like to be able to make payroll, so that's one of the tricky things.
Great.
Is that okay?
Perfect. Thanks very much, Melinda. Before I introduce the next speaker, I wanted to give a quick pitch for something that I've been paging through, a free resource that the Knight Foundation put together. I think if you just Google new media makers, you'll see it. Beth has a few copies, but I'm sure not nearly enough to meet the likely demand from this crowd. It was put together by Jan Schaefer at American, who runs the J-Lab at American. And she's trying to address this question of scalability the report seeks to, you know, come up with, you know, start to pool resources for fundraising and how do you really make that happen? There are lots of efforts underway to do that. This is just one, but it's comes with a CD. I was impressed with it, so I wanted to mention it. Our next speaker is Nick Pennyman. He's the executive director of the new Huffington Post Investigative Fund. There's a screen capture of it. Nick founded the American News Project, and he previously served as the Washington director of the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy, an important funder on environmental issues. The Schuman Foundation is an important funder, and the Schuman Center is one of the Schuman Foundation's projects. He was the publisher of the Washington Monthly, and he was the editor of TomPaine.com, among many other projects. He's had a long-time interest in environmental news and has had feet and arms in both the worlds of philanthropy and the worlds of journalism. And now he is associated with the Huffington Post, which is certainly a large presence in this new world. So take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Dan. So I guess that we're trying to create a different kind of model. It's somewhat similar to what you guys are doing, but ours is more of a nonprofit, for-profit model. The basic assumption of which is that if you're trying to do national news, you have a platform problem from the get-go. How do you get out to millions of people instantaneously? And then how do you do the follow-up work with those millions of people that's necessary to have an impact? You've got a great platform through NPR. You guys broker your platforms on a per-story basis. And so our model is probably closer to yours in a way, in that you know, we have somewhat of a brand affiliation mm-hmm. with Huffington Post. And the key, though, with this model is that whenever we publish anything on our own website, we publish it open source through a Creative Commons license. The moment it's published, it's available for anyone in the world to publish for free, including the Huffington Post Corporation. There is a pretty serious editorial firewall between the two operations. There's no editorial collaboration going on. I'm not in conversations with Dan Frumkin, the head of the D.C. Bureau, about what they're covering to make sure that we're not covering the same stuff. We're very walled off in that respect. The basic assumption of this model going forward is that enterprise and investigative reporting is a non-starter from a for-profit perspective. You know, I'd be surprised if any major media company wakes up any time in the next 5 to 10 years and decides to voluntarily start pumping millions of dollars into speculative reporting. As we all know, it costs a lot of money. It's a huge, you got to drill 100 wells to get 10 of them to pop. And for the big newspapers that are clinging to the edge of the cliff by their fingernails, they're probably not going to come to the revelation that this is what they need to be doing more of. So if this model is successful, I'm hoping that it will be replicated throughout the media industry. Just to give you some of the nuts and bolts, we have a $2 million budget. We have a full-time staff of 12. To give you a sense of the staff that we've been able to attract with this model, our executive editor is Larry Roberts, who was formerly the investigations editor of the Washington Post. He handled their Abramoff investigations. Senior editor Christine Spolar, the former Baghdad bureau chief of the Chicago Tribune. Keith Epstein, investigative reporter from Business Week. Fred Schulte, renowned investigative reporter, won 39 awards. Formerly the chief investigative reporter for the Baltimore Sun. So collectively, this little staff that we've been able to create in the last 5 months has over the course of its collective career, accrued 48 journalism awards, including 4 Pulitzers and 6 Pulitzer finalists. I'm saying that in part to brag about the great team that I work with, but in part, too, to show you that, the tremendous potential of being able to attract serious talent, and ProPublica is obviously an example of that, if you can put a viable model out there. In addition to doing the traditional deep dive reporting that is always kind of defined the investigative field, the big pieces that take 3 months and you land the 3,000-word piece with a bunch of sidebars, we're also going to get into citizen journalism. I've hired a citizen journalism director. We think that there's tremendous potential in doing two-way reporting, not just one-way reporting, and multimedia. We have, of our 12 staffers, 5 of them are video-capable. 2 of them are exclusively dedicated to video. We see no reason why, in the age in which your computer is now your television set, why we shouldn't be producing a television product in addition to a print product. So I'm going to stop there, but that's because I think we should converse. But as I said, I do think that this is easy to replicate going forward. The big key for the media companies out there is that they've got to get their head around this open source publishing, which, as you can imagine from a psychological perspective on their part, is almost anathema to how they've made their money over the course of 150 years. They're used to publishing their content and then controlling their content. Here they have to be willing to you know, help just give it away.
Great. Thank you, Nick. Finally, ProPublica. A representative from ProPublica today is Abram Lustgarten. He's the energy reporter there. He's a former staff writer and contributor for Fortune. He's written for Salon, Esquire, Washington Post, and the New York Times. He's also the author of the book China's Great Train, Beijing's Drive West, and the Campaign to Remake Tibet. So he's a very diverse guy. There's a lot of excitement in the industry about the investigative work that ProPublica is doing, and so I'm looking forward to hearing from LeBron.
Thank you. And is this working? Can you hear me? Okay. Thanks for waking up this morning. ProPublica was founded in the fall of 2007. It launched in January of 2008. It was run by Paul Steiger, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, and managing editor is Steve Engelberg, who came from the investigative unit at the New York Times and was a managing editor at the Oregonian. Is presently, I believe, the largest investigative newsroom and also operates with the largest budget of any nonprofit news organization. We have an annual budget of close to $10 million. We work out of offices in Lower Manhattan. Everybody, with the exception of three reporters, comes to work there every day. We have 32 reporters, two fellows, a couple interns, administrative staff, and a technology staff, so close to 50 people altogether. Our coverage is diverse, ranges from criminal justice and government to business to environmental work. We have two environmental reporters, including myself, and interns who pitch in on environmental subjects especially, and we're actually hiring an environmental reporter at this point. And we also work with a Creative Commons license. Our intent is to get the most eyeballs, the broadest possible audience for our stories. Our larger deep dive projects, we will specifically go out and seek a partner, and we've had some success in that. We've worked with the New York Times consistently, and the Washington Post, and the LA Times, and Business Week, and television programs like 60 Minutes and CNN. Smaller stories we'll publish on our own website, which we are also building, working to build an audience for, and make it a little bit more self-sustaining. Like all of these organizations here, I think ProPublica was founded out of the conditions that the market is in today. Its founders and its funders recognize the shortage of investigative reporters, a dwindling investigative staff, suffering of the fourth estate, if you will, and recognized this as a critical threat and thought that a nonprofit model was the way to go in and do this kind of deep, intensive, not always successful and always expensive work that can result in increased accountability, which is our primary focus, a somewhat pretty idealistic focus, to have some impact either in legislation or some kind of legal impact or some kind of visible or measurable impact that results from our stories. As I said, our annual budget is about $10 million. It comes, the vast majority of it, about 80%, comes at this point from the Sandler Foundation, so West Coast banking family. And ProPublica was their instigation, but our funding also comes from the MacArthur Foundation, the Knight Foundation, and a handful of other institutions. And we are working very hard to diversify that funding at this point. An annual budget of $10 million is extended for three years. We have funding locked up at this point through December of 2011, and then we proceed with fundraising for the fourth year, kind of on a rolling basis. This summer, we were very lucky to receive a $1 million grant from the Knight Foundation for the express purpose of diversifying that funding. The goal is to unburden both the Sandlers and ourselves from that direct tie to the Sandlers within a couple of years. We've used that money so far to hire two consultants who are now in our office and focusing on different aspects of fundraising opportunities. And they've just begun, so I don't have too much to report about what they're finding so far. aside from that fundraising, we don't have a revenue model per se, or at least we don't at this time. We don't pursue advertising. We distribute our work for free. That could change in the future. I haven't heard anything about it heading that direction. That's part of what these two consultants are brought on to take a look at. Our staff salaries are comparable with any for-profit news institution. That was kind of one of the central tenets in founding ProPublica, was the idea that to bring on talent that was going to quickly ramp up and quickly produce the kind of nationally renowned or world-renowned stories that we aim to create, that you needed some of the best people in the business. And both for editors and reporters, paying a fair salary is one quick start and a way to do that. And we've had some success in bringing on phenomenally accomplished reporters from across the country. A number of award-winning reporters from the LA Times, for example, and from a dozen newspapers elsewhere. Trying to breeze through this so we can get on to the conversation, but as far as scalability and the model being replicated elsewhere, it's something that's very difficult for me to say. I feel incredibly lucky to be a part of ProPublica. I don't necessarily think that it's very easy to just duplicate the same model elsewhere. The kind of money that we've raised may prove difficult to raise in the future, and I'm not sure I see that breadth of money out there for the taking on a consistent basis for many large organizations. I think that nonprofit newsmaking will be a part of the model going forward. I'm not sure I believe it'll be the entire model. I still think that there's got to be some for-profit solution out there to be found, though I don't know what it is. But it, at the same time, it's very exciting for me to see to be a part of what we're doing and to see what all of you are doing. It's quite inspiring.
Okay, well, thank you, all four speakers. You can tell there are as many models out there as there are sand on a beach, grains of sand on a beach. There's a lot happening in this sphere. Some of it very exciting, and some of it highly uncertain. We just don't know how it's going to work out. Before we move to Q&A, I wanted to briefly explain what these yellow cards are on your table. Okay, you already know what they are. What I'm really doing is urging you to fill one of these cards out. SEJ is a fantastic organization. For those of you whose first conference this is, you're just realizing that. SEJ, apropos of what we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes, is very much a product of charitable giving, either from foundations or from our members and other supporters. So please do fill one of these out. And what's particularly exciting this year is that we're up from 2 to 3 ways that you can choose to give. You can give directly to operating support. You can give to the endowment, which is the 21st Century Fund. When we started the 21st Century Fund, it wasn't yet the 21st century. And the third way, the latest way, is what the board discussed yesterday, the Fund for Environmental Journalism, which is very exciting. It's a way for SEJ to recognize either particular projects that are particularly exciting or helping to sort of build infrastructure for not necessarily for particular reporting projects, but for particular organizations that are trying to figure out new ways to fill this vitally important gap that keeps widening with the problems of for-profit media. So with that, if you have questions, go ahead and come to the mics. My request, as always, is that our request is that you identify yourself first, and secondly, that please don't I know there are a lot of folks here who have models that they're excited about, and please tell us about your model. But let's not turn this into sort of a series of commercials for people's individual sites. There are many people doing a lot of exciting things. So speaking of exciting sites, Mike Lemonick is at the microphone.
Thanks, Dan. And Dan gave me this speech privately earlier this morning as well. I'm Mike Lemonick. I'm with Climate Central. We're a nonprofit that does reporting about climate change, and like ProPublica, offers it for free to existing media outlets, and we'll probably transition to our own website as a primary source if people ever come there. My question is this. In some cases when I've talked to reporters who are still employed at existing media about the idea of our supplying stories about climate change, there's a certain resistance and a certain upset on the theory that by offering these things for free, we are allowing employers to fire more people, so that we're enabling or accelerating the disintegration of conventional media. Do you run into that? Do you see any ethical problem with that? And that's for any of you.
Anybody want to take that?
I mean, if this was a burgeoning field, then that might be an interesting critique, but it's not. It's a collapsing field, specifically investigative enterprise.
Right.
So in our mind, offering our content for free to anyone who wants it is a very good thing. I don't know what ProPublica.
I would reiterate the same. I mean, it's come up in conversation. I think it's a delicate balance that we try to strike in our relationships and our partners with the editors that we try to work with to come across as supporting what they do and trying to enhance their work as opposed to replace their work. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is we're usually offering reporting that they can't and won't do, and there's only so much responsibility for their own staffing that we can take on, and it's their decision whether they want to take that work and put it in their paper.
Yeah, and I would pick up on that, too. In our case, we're always trying to work with the reporters at the local public radio station in collaboration to help their work. And every now and again, stations that actually haven't bought the service, usually it's a case of their reporters saying, no, we can cover Congress from here ourselves. We don't need you to kind of... And sometimes the undercut thing has come into the conversation. And our response, we try not to say this directly, but yeah, we'll cover your council, your city council from Washington, too, So, because we really think there's no replacement for the eyewitness, I guess, reporting that can happen, and that contextual stuff from actually being there. But it does come up, yeah.
I would just throw back in, too. I mean, there's a codependency. We need those papers and those other news outlets to be healthy and robust and to exist. We're not trying to replace
them. Yeah.
Hi, Amelia Ascari, independent journalist, University of Michigan lecturer, various other things. My question is for you, Nick. You said that you think your model is replicable. And I wanted you to expand on that if you could. Did you mean at an individual metro level? Did you mean nationwide? And if you could tell me a little bit more about your funding and where you think other people could get similar funding, I was interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope that if we're successful, I would hope that the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Washington Post, other major newspapers would consider doing what we're doing, which is walling off this investigative enterprise function into an independent nonprofit organization, helping seed fund it. So Huffington Post gave me $500,000, the corporation did, to seed fund. And treating it as a separate entity. My other funding comes from the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy, which is where I used to work, Atlantic Philanthropies, and the Markle Foundation. One of the things that we're going to branch out into in our first year, though, is grassroots or small donor fundraising off the Huffington Post platform. And you can imagine how the Washington Post or the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or other newspapers could do the same thing, which is tap into their readers who care about their brand and want to see great muckraking reporting done to do fundraising drives in the same way that they do Secret Santa drives or, other kinds of drives. So that's where I was, from both a funding perspective and a kind of, hybrid nonprofit for-profit perspective. That's where I see the potential.
So So you would see the Washington Post newspaper continuing to live,
yep,
and have its best investigative stuff online?
Yep.
Funded in a different way?
But they've got to, again, they've got to be willing to publish it open source. When I started this thing, I vetted it through four teams of lawyers, two corporate, major corporate law firms and two major nonprofit firms. And they said that the open source publishing, the Creative Commons publishing, is a huge indemnifier against the charge that, that my nonprofit exists for the sake of only for the Huffington Post. And so, again, they've got to wrap their heads around the fact, the Washington Post would, that if they're going to do something like this, when they publish, they've got to publish for everyone, not the Washington Post. The other model that's similar to this that's been set up recently is the San Diego Tribune spun off one of its senior investigative editors who's now at the University of California, San Diego, and is starting a thing called the Watchdog Institute. And it's going to be a nonprofit that will work with the Trib on investigative stories. And I actually think they probably get closer to the kind of legal line than we do, and that they're going to give exclusives to the Trib. Some exclusives, not all.
It's interesting, too, to notice that legacy media, there seem to be two sort of very divergent routes that many legacy sites are taking, which is many are actually moving in the opposite direction, which is to wall off some of their investigative, you know, some of their high-value content and to try to get revenue through a subscription model. We're going to see what happens with that. While others are going the open source route, or at least, as is happening with the San Diego Project, figuring out ways to essentially outsource some of their investigative work to someone else, and then with exclusivity on their site. So there are lots of different routes, and some of them really are legally problematic, as Nick mentioned. Carolyn.
Carolyn Wetzel, California correspondent for BNA Publications. My question is for Rob and Melinda. Since the Voice of San Diego has started up and your Capital Service has started up, have you seen the local, for example, the Union Tribune, improve its local coverage in San Diego, the editorial coverage, and maybe some of the local stations, have they beefed up their efforts to cover the Capital if they are not using you? Have you paid attention to that?
I mean, they've laid off half their staff since we started.
Right.
So, no. I mean, I think they have tried to publicly focus attention on the idea that they are being public watchdogs, but they were just bought by a private equity firm. Who's being advised by a Canadian publisher that basically says the best thing to do is a lot of short, pithy stories, and not long form or in depth investigative work. So I think it's, I mean, since we started, the team that won them a Pulitzer for taking down a corrupt congressman in 2005. The majority of them are gone, and so it's gone quite in the other direction.
Yeah, in our case, public radio stations that aren't taking us aren't doing anything really from Congress. They rely on national public radio, and they take the NPR version of the story. One thing we have noticed is that NPR has really boosted its political coverage since we began, and we've always, we're very, very different because we're looking at the local thing, and we don't do what they do, or if they are doing it, we do it very differently. But they have thrown more correspondence at the national level than before, which is, I think good. The more people doing it, the better. And it's very kind of collaborative model. We have seven full-time correspondents, and the more awards we get, the more they increase their number of people covering the Capitol. So it's a nice form of flattery, so I like it.
Before I take the next question, I wanted to ask a quick one myself, take the chair's privilege, and ask about freelancing. There are a lot of very talented professional environmental freelancers in this room, and it is, of course, increasingly difficult to find good places
who will pay you for good work. So if you could each talk about your use of freelancers, and by that I mean professional journalists who work for professional rates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have, as we have added to our budget and as our budget has expanded, we've had more money for freelance work. What we pay for that depends from writer to writer and from project to project, generally starting at 50 cents a word. We have a freelancer who produces what we call the morning report now, which comes out 6 times a week and is kind of a pithy summary of our day's fare, you know, our blog posts and the stories that we've published that day. And it's much like the, you know, today's headlines or whatever that you get in your inbox from the New York Times. So he has come on and served that important role for us. We've had other journalists, you know, who have been laid off from the LA Times, but who are experts on nuclear safety, who have done projects for us examining that kind of thing. And drawing on their expertise. So we have increasingly turned to freelancers as our budget has allowed us to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use a lot of freelancers. It's partly because of the rhythm of Congress. It's really busy on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, and not so busy on Mondays and Fridays. It's a highly specialized work because one of the things I didn't talk about was how our focus has been really on keeping costs very low, the way our reporters work together, a lot of teamwork, a lot of sharing of content, someone having the front door covered, someone having the back door covered, because each one of these stories that they localize, they've got to gather it once and do it 10 different ways or sometimes 15 different ways, and so they work together. Anyway, so freelancers are highly specialized in our case, and we always at any given time have about 4 or 5 freelancers that we're relying on, which we can bring in, and we're always trying to test out and try out new talent. And we use a lot of interns, and some of our interns we end up hiring because they're very good, and we're able to train them in this very efficient way of working, and we retain them. Which is very helpful. One of the things we're experimenting now as our new website launches is working with folks outside of Washington and trying to figure out whether there are ways of kind of revenue sharing around the work that they're producing. And very early days on that. I know other people are trying that kind of experiment as well. And if anyone has any insight into the ways that could work, we're interested in learning more. But we want to try to experiment in that way too.
We have a limited budget for freelance, which will be a growing budget. We pay 50 cents to $2 a word, you know, are very open to pitches, certainly, less the big explanatory pieces and more so the kind of pieces where you've got the potential to light some kind of a firecracker somewhere, where you've got some corruption or something that could explode.
Start looking for that.
We're on the fence, I think, about freelancers. I can think of 2 that we've hired, and many more that we have not. It's due to a couple reasons. One, I think we have a shortage of editing capacity right now, and there's a lot being produced, and we haven't needed more from outside of the office. And 2, I think it's very difficult with investigative work to confidently get the level of factual accuracy and have that kind of confidence in the contributor. And on that note, we've been talking about but experimenting with how to compensate freelance work. It would be in the same range. We try to be competitive with kind of a going magazine rate, but we mull over whether it should be a contract-based, a time-based compensation as opposed to a per word, and other ways to essentially ensure that you're not encouraging just a little bit of laziness or a little bit of corners to be cut, which is just extra important in the kind of subjects that we're trying to cover. That said, I think the door's wide open, especially with an extraordinary idea that's fairly well-developed.
Hi, my name is John Flesher. I'm a reporter with the Associated Press. I'm based over in northern Michigan. I'm interested in your readers, who they are, how many they are, our listeners in your case. What brings them to you? And just wondered if you had been able to do any surveying or even had anecdotal information about what has drawn people to you. Are these people who are unhappy, disillusioned, whatever, with what they're seeing in mainstream news media, or are they well-informed people who are just enlarging their sources of information by turning to you?
For us, it's both of those. We have about 80,000 unique visitors a month, and they are predominantly old and wealthy.
In our case, the public radio listenership has been very, very strong and has been growing for some time. So a program like Morning Edition on National Public Radio has got an audience of 22 million people. So our audience of 3.1, which is Arbitron, is a calculation in terms of the frequency of our reports, in many cases daily, on a lot of stations across the country within Morning Edition, and what that individual station audience share is of that total pie. The public radio, I can talk a little bit about the public radio demographic and our own. I mean, these are people who are highly educated. They tend to split down a third Republican, a third Independent, a third Democrat, which surprised a lot of people who assume National Public Radio is only for liberals. It's really not true. It's for a lot of people who are just smart. They want a lot of information, and because it's in-depth and it's contextual. And so that audience segment has just been doing very well. So we're just part of that, I guess. And we do get a lot of feedback from listeners who just appreciate having politics made relevant to them. Because otherwise, it's kind of like, you know, really what we call what we do is news that passes the why should I care test. And it's really got to be relevant in that case. We get a lot of great feedback directly from listeners for that.
I mean, about 30 places have run our stuff since we've only been publishing for about 2 months now. Huffington Post is the most reliable, and they've got a 20 million unique monthly audience, which is, you know, mostly political junkies, and then also people who like other stuff. I mean, as you guys, anyone who goes to Huffington Post knows, there's plenty of gossip and celebrity stuff, and so it's an interesting kind of cross over readership of political junkies and elites, and then also people who are coming in for the Angeline and Brad stuff. And I'd love it if the Angeline and Brad people end up reading our piece about atrazine, you know. So really,
do they do that? Like, is there a crossover?
Yeah, that's one of the that's one of Ariana's genius insights is that like we can get these people to come in through the entertainment section and then plow them over to you know, substantive reporting and kind of high level opinion making. So
that's great.
Maybe we need a stronger entertainment section.
Yeah, I know. Thinking.
I don't know exactly what our numbers are, and excluding partnerships, which obviously go to their readers and try to break down, you know, who comes to ProPublica's website and reads it. I think it's two distinct groups. It's on one hand, professional. I think a lot of the journalism community and a lot of motivated readers who are particularly seeking out the kind of stories that we do will come to our site. And at the same time, on the other end of the spectrum, we've gotten a lot of traction with people who follow a specific topic. To speak from my own experience, you know, I've been covering natural gas drilling for most of the time since I started work there. And there's a regular readership of everyone from environmental activists to people who are, you know, using the internet for the first time in these small towns that I'm covering, to the industry that are checking in pretty regularly to see what we're doing, and that's in part because we've just built up a momentum where we're one of the key sources on that subject, and I think there's four or five subjects where ProPublica's established that kind of base readership.
We have just 2 minutes left, so if we get the last two questions, be very quick. That would be great.
On the business side of things, I'm wondering if you can talk with the view that foundations aren't, many foundations want you to be sustainable in the long term, about branding, if you've thought about cross-branding and having multiple offerings, and if you've thought about cooperatives in terms of sharing with each other resources or things like that. Mm-hmm. If you could speak to those issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a big question. Well, Melinda, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Capital News Connection is one of the founding members of the Investigative News Network, and that's exactly, and so is Voices of San Diego, and that's exactly what we're talking about. Are there ways that we can not only share resources like liability insurance or even health insurance or some of these things to cut our respective costs in some of these areas, but also can we collaborate to create bigger and better impact for all our stories and create a wider audience for all the stories we do, and can we collaborate on those stories to make the stories better? And I know Brant wants to talk about this too.
Yeah, so. That's actually an excellent
segue. Actually, Dan, though, I do want to hit on the foundation
ahead,
thing just really quickly, because I do think that I've been raising money for nonprofit media for 7 years now, and I do think that there are these light bulbs are starting to go off, thank God, in the foundation community because of the collapse of newspapering. Mm-hmm. For a long time, foundations never considered journalism to be their province. Mm-hmm. But when they look at what's going on mm-hmm. right now, I think that there are a lot of revelations mm-hmm. occurring in the major donor and foundation community. And I hope that they will realize, in the next couple of years, that the kind of journalism you all do and that we do needs to be supported civically because it is fundamentally mm-hmm. a civic function.
Yes.
Can I just jump in real quick, because I know you're running out of time. I'm the chair of the steering committee of the Investigative News Network, and I think if you're thinking about doing a nonprofit, you want to get into one of the networks that are out there. You're more progressive in where you're going. There's a great one called the Media Consortium that's been going for mm-hmm. a while. You can find it on the website. Mm-hmm. The Investigative News Network is turning into a nonprofit itself. We're going to share resources. We're going to look at distribution. I think 3 out of 4 up there are going to be part of it. ProPublica is going to collaborate but not be a member of it. So I think that's really important to know. The second thing is you should know there are really good funds out there, and they're expanding for freelance work, investigative work. Nation Institute, the Fund for Investigative Journalism, there are a bunch of those. You can talk to me afterwards. And third, just a slight correction. Nick was kind of sliding through and said that the Watchdog Institute in San Diego was spun off from the San Diego Union Tribune. Actually, Lori Hearn spent months making a deal with the new owners of the San Diego Union Tribune to be independent. It's the same as the Huffington work. It is connected, but it's going to be open source to everyone. So just so you know, it's not a spin-off. Right. So thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much. And please don't get up yet, because our host, Chuck Wernbach, has some urgent announcements. But thank you very much, and thank our panel.